state when I left home, and if I don't get there soon, she'll done swooned.
Goodbye. I'll be over this afternoon, called Mrs. Meade. And you tell Pity for me that if you aren't on my committee, she's going to be in a worse state. The carriage slipped and slid down the muddy road, and Scarlett leaned back on the cushions and smiled. She felt better now than she had felt in months. Atlanta, with its crowds and its hurry and its undercurrent of driving excitement, was very pleasant, very exhilarating, so very much nicer than the lonely plantation out from Charleston, where the bellow of alligators broke the night stillness. Better than Charleston itself, dreaming in its gardens behind its high walls. Better than Savannah, with its wide streets lined with palmetto and the muddy river beside it. Yes. And temporarily, even better than Tara, dear though Tara was. There was something exciting about this town with its narrow, muddy streets, lying among rolling red hills, something raw and crude that appealed to the rawness and crudeness underlying the fine veneer that Ellen and Mammy had given her. She suddenly felt that this was where she belonged. Not in serene and quiet old cities, flat beside yellow waters. The houses were farther and farther apart now, and leaning out, Scarlett saw the red brick and slate roof of Miss Pittypat's house. It was almost the last house on the north side of town. Beyond it, Peachtree Road narrowed and twisted under great trees, out of sight into thick, quiet woods. The neat wooden-paneled fence had been newly painted white, and the front yard it enclosed was yellow-starred with the last jonquils of the season. On the front step stood two women in black, and behind them a large yellow woman with her hands under her apron and her white teeth showing in a wide smile. Plump Miss Pittypat was teetering excitedly on tiny feet, one hand pressed to her copious bosom to still her fluttering heart. Scarlett saw Melanie standing by her side, and, with a surge of dislike, she realized that the fly in the ointment of Atlanta would be this slight little person in black mourning dress, her riotous dark curls subdued to matronly smoothness, and a loving smile of welcome and happiness on her heart-shaped face. When a southerner took the trouble to pack a trunk and travel 20 miles for a visit, the visit was seldom of shorter duration than a month, usually much longer. Southerners were as enthusiastic visitors as they were hosts, and there was nothing unusual in relatives coming to spend the Christmas holidays and remaining until July. Often, when newly married couples went on the usual round of honeymoon visits, they lingered in some pleasant home until the birth of their second child. Frequently, elderly aunts and uncles came to Sunday dinner and remained until they were buried years later. Visitors presented no problem, for houses were large, servants numerous, and the feeding of several extra mouths a minor matter in that land of plenty. All ages and sexes went visiting. Honeymooners, young mothers showing off new babies, convalescents, the bereaved, girls whose parents were anxious to remove them from the dangers of unwise matches, girls who had reached the danger age without becoming engaged and who, it was hoped, would make suitable matches under the guidance of relatives in other places. Visitors added excitement and variety to the slow-moving southern life, and they were always welcome. So Scarlett had come to Atlanta with no idea as to how long she would remain. If her visit proved as dull as those in Savannah and Charleston, she would return home in a month. If her stay was pleasant, she would remain indefinitely. But no sooner had she arrived than Aunt Pittypat and Melanie began a campaign to induce her to make her home permanently with them. They brought up every possible argument. They wanted her for her own self because they loved her. They were lonely and often frightened at night in the big house, and she was so brave she gave them courage. She was so charming that she cheered them in their sorrow. Now that Charles was dead, her place and her son's place were with his kindred. Besides, half the house now belonged to her through Charles's will. Last, the Confederacy needed every pair of hands for sewing, knitting, bandage-rolling, and nursing the wounded. Charles's uncle Henry Hamilton, who lived in bachelor state at the Atlanta Hotel near the depot, also talked seriously to her on this subject. Uncle Henry was a short, pot-bellied, irascible old gentleman with a pink face, a shock of long silver hair, and an utter lack of patience with feminine timidities and vaporings. It was for the latter reason that he was barely on speaking terms with his sister, Miss Pittypat. From childhood, they had been exact opposites in temperament, and they had been further estranged by his objections to the manner in which she had reared Charles. "Making a damn sissy out of a soldier's son." Years before, he had so insulted her that now Miss Pitty never spoke of him except in guarded whispers, and with so great reticence that a stranger would have thought the honest old lawyer a murderer, at the least. The insult had occurred on a day when Pitty wished to draw $500 from her estate, of which he was trustee, to invest in a non-existent gold mine. He had refused to permit it, and stated heatedly that she had no more sense than a June bug, and furthermore it gave him the fidgets to be around her longer than 5 minutes. Since that day, she only saw him formally, once a month, when Uncle Peter drove her to his office to get the housekeeping money. After these brief visits, Pitty always took to her bed for the rest of the day with tears and smelling salts. Melanie and Charles, who were on excellent terms with their uncle, had frequently offered to relieve her of this ordeal, but Pitty always set her babyish mouth firmly and refused. Henry was her cross, and she must bear him. From this, Charles and Melanie could only infer that she took a profound pleasure in this occasional excitement, the only excitement in her sheltered life. Uncle Henry liked Scarlett immediately, because, he said, he could see that for all her silly affectations, she had a few grains of sense. He was trustee, not only of Pitty's and Melanie's estates, but also of that left Scarlett by Charles. It came to Scarlett as a pleasant surprise that she was now a well-to-do young woman, for Charles had not only left her half of Aunt Pitty's house, but farmlands and town property as well. And the stores and warehouses along the railroad track near the depot, which were part of her inheritance, had tripled in value since the war began. It was when Uncle Henry was giving her an account of her property that he broached the matter of her permanent residence in Atlanta.
"When Wade Hampton comes of age, he's going to be a rich young man," he said. "The way Atlanta is growing, his property will be 10 times more valuable in 20 years, and it's only right that a boy should be raised where his property is, so he can learn to take care of it. Yes, and of Pitty's and Melanie's, too. He'll be the only man of the Hamilton name left before long, for I won't be here forever."
As for Uncle Peter, he took it for granted that Scarlett had come to stay. It was inconceivable to him that Charles's only son should be reared where he could not supervise the rearing. To all these arguments, Scarlett smiled, but said nothing, unwilling to commit herself before learning how she would like Atlanta and constant association with her in-laws. She knew, too, that Gerald and Ellen would have to be won over. Moreover, now that she was away from Tara, she missed it dreadfully, missed the red fields and the springing green cotton and the sweet twilight silences. For the first time, she realized dimly what Gerald had meant when he said that the love of the land was in her blood. So she gracefully evaded, for the time being, a definite answer as to the duration of her visit, and slipped easily into the life of the red brick house at the quiet end of Peachtree Street. living with Charles's blood kin, seeing the home from which he came, Scarlet could now understand a little better the boy who had made her wife, widow, and mother in such rapid succession. It was easy to see why he had been so shy, so unsophisticated, so idealistic. If Charles had inherited any of the qualities of the stern, fearless, hot-tempered soldier who had been his father, they had been obliterated in childhood by the ladylike atmosphere in which he had been reared. He had been devoted to the childlike pity, and closer than brothers usually are to Melanie. And two more sweet, unworldly women could not be found. Aunt Pittypat had been christened Sarah Jane Hamilton 60 years before. But since the long past day when her doting father had fastened this nickname upon her, because of her airy, restless, pattering little feet, no one had called her anything else. In the years that followed that second christening, many changes had taken place in her that made the pet name incongruous. Of the swiftly scampering child, all that now remained were two tiny feet, inadequate to her weight, and a tendency to prattle happily and aimlessly. She was stout, pink-cheeked and silver-haired, and always a little breathless from too tightly laced stays. She was unable to walk more than a block on the tiny feet, which she crammed into two small slippers. She had a heart which fluttered at any excitement, and she pampered it shamelessly, fainting at any provocation. Everyone knew that her swoons were generally mere ladylike pretenses, but they loved her enough to refrain from saying so. Everyone loved her, spoiled her like a child, and refused to take her seriously. Everyone except her brother Henry. She liked gossip better than anything else in the world, even more than she liked the pleasures of the table, and she prattled on for hours about other people's affairs in a harmless, kindly way. She had no memory for names, dates, or places, and frequently confused the actors in one Atlanta drama with the actors in another, which misled no one, for no one was foolish enough to take seriously anything she said. No one ever told her anything really shocking or scandalous, for her spinster state must be protected, even if she was 60 years old. And her friends were in a kindly conspiracy to keep her a sheltered and petted old child. Melanie was like her aunt in many ways. She had her shyness, her sudden blushes, her modesty. But she did have common sense. Of a sort, I'll admit that, Scarlet thought grudgingly. Like Aunt Pity, Melanie had the face of a sheltered child who had never known anything but simplicity and kindness, truth and love. A child who had never looked upon harshness or evil and would not recognize them if she saw them. Because she had always been happy, she wanted everyone about her to be happy or at least pleased with themselves. To this end, she always saw the best in everyone and remarked kindly upon it. There was no servant so stupid that she did not find some redeeming trait of loyalty and kind-heartedness. No girl so ugly and disagreeable that she could not discover grace of form or nobility of character in her. And no man so worthless or so boring that she did not view him in the light of his possibilities rather than his actualities. Because of these qualities that came sincerely and spontaneously from a generous heart, everyone flocked about her. For who can resist the charm of one who discovers in others admirable qualities undreamed of even by himself? She had more girlfriends than anyone in town, and more men friends, too, though she had few beaus, for she lacked the willfulness and selfishness that go far toward trapping men's hearts. What Melanie did was no more than all Southern girls were taught to do, to make those about them feel at ease and pleased with themselves. It was this happy feminine conspiracy which made Southern society so pleasant. Women knew that a land where men were contented, uncontradicted, and safe in possession of unpunctured vanity, was likely to be a very pleasant place for women to live. So, from the cradle to the grave, women strove to make men pleased with themselves, and the satisfied men repaid lavishly with gallantry and adoration. In fact, men willingly gave the ladies everything in the world except credit for having intelligence. Scarlet exercised the same charms as Melanie, but with a studied artistry and consummate skill. The difference between the two girls lay in the fact that Melanie spoke kind and flattering words from a desire to make people happy, if only temporarily. And Scarlet never did it except to further her own aims. From the two he loved best, Charles had received no toughening influences, learned nothing of harshness or reality, and the home in which he grew to manhood was as soft as a bird's nest. It was such a quiet, old-fashioned, gentle home compared with Tara. To Scarlet, this house cried out for the masculine smells of brandy, tobacco, and macassar oil, for hoarse voices and occasional curses, for guns, for whiskers, for saddles and bridles, and for hounds underfoot. She missed the sounds of quarreling voices that were always heard at Tara when Ellen's back was turned. Mammy quarreling with Pork, Rosa and Tina bickering, her own acrimonious arguments with Sue Ellen, Gerald's bawling threats. No wonder Charles had been a sissy, coming from a home like this. Here, excitement never entered in. Voices were never raised. Everyone deferred gently to the opinions of others, and in the end, the black, grizzled autocrat in the kitchen had his way. Scarlet, who had hoped for a freer rein when she escaped Mammy's supervision, discovered to her sorrow that Uncle Peter's standards of ladylike conduct, especially for Miss Charles's widow, were even stricter than Mammy's. In such a household, Scarlet came back to herself, and almost before she realized it, her spirits rose to normal. She was only 17. She had superb health and energy, and Charles's people did their best to make her happy. If they fell a little short of this, it was not their fault, for no one could take out of her heart the ache that throbbed whenever Ashley's name was mentioned. And Melanie mentioned it so often. But Melanie and Pity were tireless in planning ways to soothe the sorrow under which they thought she labored. They put their own grief into the background in order to divert her. They fussed about her food and her hours for taking afternoon naps and for taking carriage rides. They not only admired her extravagantly, her high-spiritedness, her figure, her tiny hands and feet, her white skin, but they said so frequently, petting, hugging and kissing her to emphasize their loving words. Scarlet did not care for the caresses, but she basked in the compliments. No one at Tara had ever said so many charming things about her. In fact, Mammy had spent her time deflating her conceit. Little Wade was no longer an annoyance, for the family, black and white, and the neighbors idolized him, and there was a never-ceasing rivalry as to whose lap he should occupy. Melanie, especially, doted on him. Even in his worst screaming spells, Melanie thought him adorable and said so, adding, "Oh, you precious darling, I just wish you were mine." Sometimes Scarlet found it hard to dissemble her feelings, for she still thought Aunt Pity the silliest of old ladies, and her vagueness and vaporings irritated her unendurably. She disliked Melanie with a jealous dislike that grew as the days went by, and sometimes she had to leave the room abruptly when Melanie, beaming with loving pride, spoke of Ashley or read his letters aloud. But all in all, life went on as happily as was possible under the circumstances. Atlanta was more interesting than Savannah or Charleston or Tara, and it offered so many strange wartime occupations that she had little time to think or mope. But sometimes, when she blew out the candle and burrowed her head into the pillow, she sighed and thought, "If only Ashley wasn't married. If only I didn't have to nurse in that plagued hospital. Oh, if only I could have some beaux." She had immediately loathed nursing, but she could not escape this duty because she was on both Mrs. Meade's and Mrs. Merriweather's committees. That meant 4 mornings a week in the sweltering, stinking hospital, with her hair tied up in a towel and a hot apron covering her from neck to feet. Every matron, old or young, in Atlanta, nursed, and did it with an enthusiasm that seemed to Scarlett little short of fanatic. They took it for granted that she was imbued with their own patriotic fervor, and would have been shocked to know how slight an interest in the war she had. Except for the ever-present torment that Ashley might be killed, the war interested her not at all. And nursing was something she did simply because she didn't know how to get out of it. Certainly there was nothing romantic about nursing. To her, it meant groans, delirium, death, and smells. The hospitals were filled with dirty, bewhiskered, verminous men who smelled terribly and bore on their bodies wounds hideous enough to turn a Christian's stomach. The hospital stank of gangrene, the odor assaulting her nostrils long before the doors were reached. A sickish, sweet smell that clung to her hands and hair and haunted her in her dreams. Flies and mosquitoes and gnats hovered in droning, singing swarms over the wards, tormenting the men to curses and weak sobs. And Scarlett, scratching her own mosquito bites, swung palmetto fans until her shoulders ached, and she wished that all the men were dead. Melanie, however, did not seem to mind the smells, the wounds, or the nakedness, which Scarlett thought strange in one who was the most timorous and modest of women. Sometimes, when holding basins and instruments while Dr. Meade cut out gangrened flesh, Melanie looked very white. And once, after such an operation, Scarlett found her in the linen closet vomiting quietly into a towel. But as long as she was where the wounded could see her, she was gentle, sympathetic and cheerful, and the men in the hospitals called her an angel of mercy. Scarlett would have liked that title, too. But it involved touching men crawling with lice, running fingers down throats of unconscious patients to see if they were choking on swallowed tobacco quids, bandaging stumps, and picking maggots out of festering flesh. No, she did not like nursing. Perhaps it might have been endurable if she had been permitted to use her charms on the convalescent men, for many of them were attractive and well-born. But this she could not do in her widowed state. The young ladies of the town, who were not permitted to nurse for fear they would see sights unfit for virgin eyes, had the convalescent wards in their charge. Unhampered by matrimony or widowhood, they made vast inroads on the convalescents. And even the least attractive girls, Scarlett observed gloomily, had no difficulty in getting engaged. With the exception of desperately ill and severely wounded men, Scarlett's was a completely feminized world, and this irked her, for she neither liked nor trusted her own sex, and worse still, was always bored by it. But on 3 afternoons a week, she had to attend sewing circles and bandage-rolling committees of Melanie's friends. The girls who had all known Charles were very kind and attentive to her at these gatherings, especially Fanny Elsing and Maybelle Merriweather, the daughters of the town dowagers. But they treated her deferentially, as if she were old and finished. And their constant chatter of dances and beaux made her both envious of their pleasures and resentful that her widowhood barred her from such activities. Why, she was 3 times as attractive as Fanny and Maybelle. Oh, how unfair life was! How unfair that everyone should think her heart was in the grave when it wasn't at all. It was in Virginia, with Ashley. But in spite of these discomforts, Atlanta pleased her very well. And her visit lengthened as the weeks slipped by. Chapter 9. Scarlett sat in the window of her bedroom that midsummer morning and disconsolately watched the wagons and carriages full of girls, soldiers, and chaperones ride gaily out Peachtree Road in search of woodland decorations for the bazaar, which was to be held that evening for the benefit of the hospitals. The red road lay checkered in shade and sun glare beneath the overarching trees, and the many hooves kicked up little red clouds of dust. One wagon, ahead of the others, bore 4 stout negroes with axes to cut evergreens and drag down the vines. And the back of this wagon was piled high with napkin-covered hampers, split oak baskets of lunch, and 12 watermelons. 2 of the black bucks were equipped with banjo and harmonica, and they were rendering a spirited version of "If You Want to Have a Good Time, Join the Cavalry." Behind them streamed the merry cavalcade, girls cool in flowered cotton dresses, with light shawls, bonnets, and mitts to protect their skins, and little parasols held over their heads. Elderly ladies placid and smiling amid the laughter, and carriage-to-carriage calls and jokes. Convalescents from the hospitals wedged in between stout chaperones and slender girls, who made great fuss and to-do over them. Officers on horseback idling at snail's pace beside the carriages. Wheels creaking, spurs jingling, gold braid gleaming, parasols bobbing, fans swishing, negroes singing. Everybody was riding out Peachtree Road to gather greenery and have a picnic and melon cutting. Everybody, thought Scarlett morosely, except me. They all waved and called to her as they went by, and she tried to respond with a good grace, but it was difficult. A hard little pain had started in her heart and was traveling slowly up toward her throat, where it would become a lump, and the lump would soon become tears. Everybody was going to the picnic except her. And everybody was going to the bazaar and the ball tonight except her. That is, everybody except her and Pitypat and Melly and the other unfortunates in town who were in mourning. But Melly and Pitypat did not seem to mind. It had not even occurred to them to want to go. It had occurred to Scarlett, and she did want to go, tremendously. It simply wasn't fair. She had worked twice as hard as any girl in town getting things ready for the bazaar. She had knitted socks and baby caps and afghans and mufflers and tatted yards of lace and painted china hair receivers and mustache cups. And she had embroidered 6 sofa pillowcases with a Confederate flag on them. The stars were a bit lopsided, to be sure, some of them almost being round and others having 6 or even 7 points, but the effect was good. Yesterday she had worked until she was worn out in the dusty old barn of an armory, draping yellow and pink and green cheesecloth on the booths that lined the walls. Under the supervision of the ladies' hospital committee, this was plain hard work and no fun at all. It was never fun to be around Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing and Mrs. Whiting and have them boss you like you were one of their darkies, and have to listen to them brag about how popular their daughters were. And worst of all, she had burned 2 blisters on her fingers helping Pitypat and Cookie make layer cakes for raffling. And now, having worked like a field hand, she had to retire decorously when the fun was just beginning. Oh, it wasn't fair that she should have a dead husband and a baby yelling in the next room and be out of everything that was pleasant. Just a little over a year ago, she was dancing and wearing bright clothes instead of this dark mourning, and was practically engaged to 3 boys. She was only 17 now, and there was still a lot of dancing left in her feet. Oh, it wasn't fair! Life was going past her, down a hot, shady summer road. Life with gray uniforms and jingling spurs and flowered organdy dresses and banjos playing. She tried not to smile and waved too enthusiastically to the men she knew best, the ones she'd nursed in the hospital. But it was hard to subdue her dimples, hard to look as though her heart were in the grave, when it wasn't. Her bowing and waving were abruptly halted when Pitty-Pat entered the room, panting as usual from climbing the stairs, and jerked her away from the window unceremoniously. "Have you lost your mind, honey? Waving at men out of your bedroom window? I declare, Scarlet, I'm shocked. What would your mother say?"
"Well, they didn't know it was my bedroom."
"But they suspect it was your bedroom, and that's just as bad. Honey, you mustn't do things like that. Everybody will be talking about you and saying you are fast. And anyway, Mrs. Merriweather knew it was your bedroom. And I suppose she'll tell all the boys, the old cat." "Honey, hush. Dolly Merriweather's my best friend."
"Well, she's a cat just the same."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Auntie, don't cry. I forgot it was my bedroom window. I won't do it again. I just wanted to see them go by. I wish I was going. Honey." "Well, I do. I'm so tired of sitting at home."
"Scarlet, promise me that you won't say things like that."
"People would talk so. They'd say you didn't have proper respect for poor Charlie."
"Oh, Auntie, don't cry."
"Oh, now I've made you cry, too,"
sobbed Pitty-Pat, in a pleased way, fumbling in her skirt pocket for her handkerchief. The hard little pain had at last reached Scarlet's throat, and she wailed out loud. Not, as Pitty-Pat thought, for poor Charlie, but because the last sound of the wheels and the laughter were dying away. Melanie rustled in from her room, a worried frown puckering her forehead, a brush in her hands, her usually tidy black hair, freed of its net, fluffing about her face in a mass of tiny curls and waves.
"Darlings, what's the matter?"
"Charlie," sobbed Pitty-Pat, surrendering utterly to the pleasure of her grief and burying her head on Melly's shoulder.
"Oh,"
said Melly, her lip quivering at the mention of her brother's name.
"Be brave, dear. Don't cry. Oh, Scarlet."
Scarlet had thrown herself on the bed and was sobbing at the top of her voice, sobbing for her lost youth and the pleasures of youth that were denied her, sobbing with the indignation and despair of a child who once could get anything she wanted by sobbing, and now knows that sobbing can no longer help her. She burrowed her head in the pillow and cried and kicked with her feet at the tufted counterpane.
"I might as well be dead," she sobbed passionately.
Before such an exhibition of grief, Pitty-Pat's easy tears ceased, and Melly flew to the bedside to comfort her sister-in-law.
"Dear, don't cry. Try to think how much Charlie loved you, and let that comfort you. Try to think of your darling baby."
Indignation at being misunderstood mingled with Scarlet's forlorn feeling of being out of everything and strangled all utterance. That was fortunate. for if she could have spoken, she would have cried out truths couched in Gerald's forthright words. Melanie patted her shoulder, and Pitty-Pat tiptoed heavily about the room, pulling down the shades.
"Don't do that!"
shouted Scarlet, raising a red and swollen face from the pillow.
"I'm not dead enough for you to pull down the shades, though I might as well be. Oh, do go away and leave me alone."
She sank her face into the pillow again, and after a whispered conference, the two standing over her tiptoed out. She heard Melanie say to Pitty-Pat, in a low voice as they went down the stairs, "Aunt Pitty, I wish you wouldn't speak of Charles to her. You know how it always affects her. Poor thing, she gets that queer look. And I know she's trying not to cry. We mustn't make it harder for her." Scarlet kicked the coverlet in impotent rage, trying to think of something bad enough to say.
"God's nightgown!"
she cried at last, and felt somewhat relieved. How could Melanie be content to stay at home and never have any fun and wear crepe for her brother when she was only 18 years old? Melanie did not seem to know or care that life was riding by with jingling spurs. "But she's such a stick," thought Scarlet, pounding the pillow. "And she never was popular like me, so she doesn't miss the things I miss. And besides, she's got Ashley, and I haven't got anybody." And at this fresh woe, she broke into renewed outcries. She remained gloomily in her room until afternoon. And then the sight of the returning picnickers, with wagons piled high with pine boughs, vines and ferns, did not cheer her. Everyone looked happily tired as they waved to her again, and she returned their greetings drearily. Life was a hopeless affair, and certainly not worth living. Deliverance came in the form she least expected when, during the after-dinner nap period, Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing drove up. Startled at having callers at such an hour, Melanie, Scarlet, and Aunt Pitty-Pat roused themselves, hastily hooked their basques, smoothed their hair, and descended to the parlor.
"Mrs. Bunnell's children have the measles," said Mrs. Merriweather abruptly, showing plainly that she held Mrs. Bunnell personally responsible for permitting such a thing to happen.
"And the McClure girls have been called to Virginia," said Mrs. Elsing in her die-away voice, fanning herself languidly, as if neither this nor anything else mattered very much. "Dallas McClure is wounded."
"How dreadful!" chorused their hostesses. "Is poor Dallas—"
"No, just through the shoulder,"
said Mrs. Merriweather briskly.
"But it couldn't possibly have happened at a worse time. The girls are going north to bring him home. But skies above, we haven't time to sit here talking. We must hurry back to the armory and get the decorating done. Pity, we need you and Melly tonight to take Mrs. Bunnell's and the McClure girls' places."
"Oh, but, Dolly, we can't go."
"Don't say can't to me, Pitty-Pat Hamilton,"
said Mrs. Merriweather vigorously.
"We need you to watch the dockies with refreshments. That was what Mrs. Bunnell was to do. And, Melly, you must take the McClure girls' booth."
"Oh, we just couldn't, with poor Charlie dead only a—"
"I know how you feel, but there isn't any sacrifice too great for the cause," broke in Mrs. Elsing in a soft voice that settled matters.
"Oh, we'd love to help, but why can't you get some sweet, pretty girls to take the booths?"
Mrs. Merriweather snorted a trumpeting snort.
"I don't know what's come over the young people these days. They have no sense of responsibility. All the girls who haven't already taken booths have more excuses than you could shake a stick at. Oh, they don't fool me. They just don't want to be hampered in making up to the officers, that's all. And they're afraid their new dresses won't show off behind booth counters. I wish to goodness that blockade runner... What's his name?
Captain Butler, supplied Mrs. Elsing.
I wish he'd bring in more hospital supplies and less hoop skirts and lace. If I've had to look at one dress today, I've had to look at 20 dresses that he ran in. Captain Butler, I'm sick of the name. Now, Pity, I haven't time to argue. You must come. Everybody will understand. Nobody will see you in the back room anyway, and Melly won't be conspicuous. The poor McClure girl's booth is way down at the end, and not very pretty, so nobody will notice you.
I think we should go, said Scarlett, trying to curb her eagerness and to keep her face earnest and simple. It's the least we can do for the hospital.
Neither of the visiting ladies had even mentioned her name, and they turned and looked sharply at her. Even in their extremity, they had not considered asking a widow of scarcely a year to appear at a social function. Scarlett bore their gaze with wide-eyed, childlike expression.
I think we should go and help to make it a success, all of us. I think I should go in the booth with Melly because... Well, I think it would look better for us both to be there instead of just one. Don't you think so, Melly?
Well, began Melly helplessly. The idea of appearing publicly at a social gathering while in mourning was so unheard of, she was bewildered.
Scarlett's right, said Mrs. Merriweather, observing signs of weakening.
She rose and jerked her hoops into place.
Both of you. All of you must come. Now, Pity, don't start your excuses again. Just think how much the hospital needs money for new beds and drugs. And I know Charlie would like you to help the cause he died for.
Well, said Pitypat, helpless, as always, in the presence of a stronger personality.
If you think people will understand...
Too good to be true, too good to be true, sang Scarlett's joyful heart as she slipped unobtrusively into the pink and yellow draped booth that was to have been the McClure girls. Actually, she was at a party. After a year's seclusion, after crepe and hushed voices and nearly going crazy with boredom, she was actually at a party, the biggest party Atlanta had ever seen. And she could see people and many lights and hear music and view for herself the lovely laces and frocks and frills that the famous Captain Butler had run through the blockade on his last trip.
She sank down on one of the little stools behind the counter of the booth and looked up and down the long hall which, until this afternoon, had been a bare and ugly drill room. How the ladies must have worked today to bring it to its present beauty. It looked lovely. Every candle and candlestick in Atlanta must be in this hall tonight, she thought. Silver ones with a dozen sprangling arms. China ones with charming figurines clustering their bases. Old brass stands, erect and dignified, laden with candles of all sizes and colors, smelling fragrantly of bayberries. Standing on the gun racks that ran the length of the hall. And on the long flower-decked tables, on booth counters, even on the sills of the open windows where the drafts of warm summer air were just strong enough to make them flare. In the center of the hall, the huge ugly lamp, hanging from the ceiling by rusty chains, was completely transformed by twining ivy and wild grapevines that were already withering from the heat. The walls were banked with pine branches that gave out a spicy smell, making the corners of the room into pretty bowers where the chaperones and old ladies would sit. Long, graceful ropes of ivy and grapevine and smilax were hung everywhere, in looping festoons on the walls, draped above the windows, twined in scallops all over the brightly colored cheesecloth booths. And everywhere, amid the greenery, on flags and bunting, blazed the bright stars of the Confederacy on their background of red and blue. The raised platform for the musicians was especially artistic.
It was completely hidden from view by the banked greenery and starry bunting, and Scarlet knew that every potted and tubbed plant in town was there. Coleus, geranium, hydrangea, oleander, elephant ear. Even Mrs. Elsing's four treasured rubber plants, which were given posts of honor at the four corners. At the other end of the hall from the platform, the ladies had eclipsed themselves. On this wall hung large pictures of President Davis and Georgia's own Little Alec Stevens, vice president of the Confederacy. Above them was an enormous flag, and beneath, on long tables, was the loot of the gardens of the town, ferns, banks of roses, crimson and yellow and white, proud sheaths of golden gladioli, masses of varicolored nasturtiums, tall, stiff hollyhocks rearing deep maroon and creamy heads above the other flowers. Among them, candles burned serenely like altar fires. The two faces looked down on the scene. Two faces as different as could be possible in two men at the helm of so momentous an undertaking. Davis, with the flat cheeks and cold eyes of an ascetic, his thin, proud lips set firmly. Stevens, with dark, burning eyes, deep-socketed, in a face that had known nothing but sickness and pain and had triumphed over them with humor and with fire. Two faces that were greatly loved. The elderly ladies of the committee, in whose hands rested the responsibility for the whole bazaar, rustled in as importantly as full-rigged ships, hurried the belated young matrons and giggling girls into their booths, and then swept through the doors into the back rooms where the refreshments were being laid out. Aunt Pity panted out after them. The musicians clamored upon their platform, black, grinning, their fat cheeks already shining with perspiration, and began tuning their fiddles and sawing and whanging with their bows in anticipatory importance. Old Levi, Mrs. Merriweather's coachman, who had led the orchestras for every bazaar, ball, and wedding since Atlanta was named Marthasville, rapped with his bow for attention. Few, except the ladies who were conducting the bazaar, had arrived yet, but all eyes turned toward him. Then the fiddles, bull fiddles, accordions, banjos, and knuckle bones broke into a slow rendition of Lorena. Too slow for dancing. The dancing would come later when the booths were emptied of their wares. Scarlet felt her heart beat faster as the sweet melancholy of the waltz came to her. The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun's far down the sky, Lorena. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, dip, sway, 3, turn, 2, 3. What a beautiful waltz. She extended her hands slightly, closed her eyes, and swayed with a sad, haunting rhythm. There was something about the tragic melody and Lorena's lost love that mingled with her own excitement and brought a lump into her throat. Then, as if brought into being by the waltz music, sounds floated in from the shadowy moonlit street below. The trample of horses' hooves and the sound of carriage wheels, laughter on the warm, sweet air, and the soft acrimony of Negro voices raised in argument over hitching places for the horses. There was confusion on the stairs and light-hearted merriment, the mingling of girls' fresh voices with the bass notes of their escorts, airy cries of greeting and squeals of joy as girls recognized friends from whom they had parted only that afternoon. Suddenly the hall burst into life. It was full of girls. Girls who floated in butterfly-bright dresses, hooped out enormously, lace pantalettes peeping from beneath. Round little white shoulders bare,
and faintest traces of soft little bosoms showing above lace flounces. Lace shawls carelessly hanging from arms. Fans spangled and painted. Fans of swan's down and peacock feathers, dangling at wrists by tiny velvet ribbons. Girls with dark hair smoothed sleekly from ears into chignons so heavy that their heads were tilted back with saucy pride. Girls with masses of golden curls about their necks and fringed gold ear-bobs that tossed and danced with their dancing curls. Laces and silks and braid and ribbons, all blockade run, all the more precious and more proudly worn because of it. Finery flaunted with an added pride as an extra affront to the Yankees. Not all the flowers of the town were standing in tribute to the leaders of the Confederacy. The smallest, the most fragrant blossoms, bedecked the girls. Tea roses tucked behind pink ears, cape jessamine and bud roses in round little garlands over cascades of side curls, blossoms thrust demurely into satin sashes, flowers that, before the night was over, would find their way into the breast pockets of gray uniforms as treasured souvenirs. There were so many uniforms in the crowd, so many uniforms on so many men whom Scarlet knew, men she had met on hospital cots, on the streets, at the drill ground. There were such resplendent uniforms, brave with shining buttons and dazzling with twined gold braid on cuffs and collars, the red and yellow and blue stripes on the trousers, for the different branches of the service, setting off the gray to perfection. Scarlet and gold sashes swung to and fro. Sabers glittered and banged against shining boots, spurs rattled and jingled. Such handsome men, thought Scarlet, with a swell of pride in her heart, as the men called greetings, waved to friends, bent low over the hands of elderly ladies. All of them were so young-looking, even with their sweeping yellow mustaches and full black and brown beards, so handsome, so reckless, with their arms in slings, with head bandages startlingly white across sun-browned faces. Some of them were on crutches, and how proud were the girls who solicitously slowed their steps to their escort's hopping pace. There was one gaudy splash of color among the uniforms that put the girls' bright finery to shame, and stood out in the crowd like a tropical bird. A Louisiana zouave, with baggy blue and white striped pants, cream gaiters and tight little red jacket, a dark, grinning little monkey of a man, with his arm in a black silk sling. He was Maybelle Merriweather's especial beau, René Picard. The whole hospital must have turned out, at least everybody who could walk. And all the men on furlough and sick leave, and all the railroad and mail service and hospital and commissary departments between here and Macon. How pleased the ladies would be. The hospital should make a mint of money tonight. There was a ruffle of drums from the street below, the tramp of feet, the admiring cries of coachmen. A bugle blared and a bass voice shouted the command to break ranks. In a moment, the home guard and the militia unit in their bright uniforms shook the narrow stairs and crowded into the room, bowing, saluting, shaking hands. There were boys in the home guard, proud to be playing at war, promising themselves that they would be in Virginia this time next year, if the war would just last that long. Old men with white beards, wishing they were younger, proud to march in uniform in the reflected glory of suns at the front. In the militia, there were many middle-aged men, and some older men, but there was a fair sprinkling of men of military age who did not carry themselves quite so jauntily as their elders or their juniors. Already people were beginning to whisper, asking why they were not with Lee. How would they all get into the hall? It had seemed such a large place a few minutes before, and now it was packed, warm with summer night odors of sachet and cologne water, and hair pomade, and burning bayberry candles,
fragrant with flowers, faintly dusty as many feet trod the old drill floors. The din and hubbub of voices made it almost impossible to hear anything, and as if feeling the joy and excitement of the occasion, old Levi choked off Lorena in mid-bar, rapped sharply with his bow, and, sawing away for dear life, the orchestra burst into Bonnie Blue Flag. 100 voices took it up, sang it, shouted it like a cheer. The home guard bugler, climbing onto the platform, caught up with the music just as the chorus began, and the high silver notes soared out thrillingly above the massed singing, causing goosebumps to break out on bare arms and cold chills of deeply felt emotion to fly down spines.
Hurrah! Hurrah! For the Southern rights! Hurrah! Hurrah! For the bonny blue flag that bears a single star!
They crashed into the second verse, and Scarlett, singing with the rest, heard the high sweet soprano of Melanie mounting behind her, clear and true and thrilling as the bugle notes. Turning, she saw that Melly was standing with her hands clasped to her breast, her eyes closed, and tiny tears oozing from the corners. She smiled at Scarlett whimsically as the music ended, making a little moo of apology as she dabbed with her handkerchief.
"I'm so happy," she whispered, "and so proud of the soldiers that I just can't help crying about it."
There was a deep, almost fanatic glow in her eyes that for a moment lit up her plain little face and made it beautiful. The same look was on the faces of all the women as the song ended, tears of pride on cheeks, pink or wrinkled, smiles on lips, a deep hot glow in eyes as they turned to their men, sweetheart to lover, mother to son, wife to husband. They were all beautiful, with a blinding beauty that transfigures even the plainest woman when she is utterly protected and utterly loved, and is giving back that love a thousandfold. They loved their men. They believed in them. They trusted them to the last breaths of their bodies. How could disaster ever come to women such as they when their stalwart gray line stood between them and the Yankees? Had there ever been such men as these since the first dawn of the world, so heroic, so reckless, so gallant, so tender? How could anything but overwhelming victory come to a cause as just and right as theirs? A cause they loved as much as they loved their men. A cause they served with their hands and their hearts. A cause they talked about, thought about, dreamed about. A cause to which they would sacrifice these men, if need be, and bear their loss as proudly as the men bore their battle flags. It was a high tide of devotion and pride in their hearts, high tide of the Confederacy, for final victory was at hand. Stonewall Jackson's triumphs in the Valley and the defeat of the Yankees in the 7 days' battle around Richmond showed that clearly. How could it be otherwise with such leaders as Lee and Jackson? One more victory, and the Yankees would be on their knees yelling for peace, and the men would be riding home, and there would be kissing and laughter. One more victory, and the war was over. Of course, there were empty chairs and babies who would never see their fathers' faces, and unmarked graves by lonely Virginia creeks, and in the still mountains of Tennessee. But was that too great a price to pay for such a cause? Silks for the ladies and tea and sugar were hard to get, but that was something to joke about. Besides, the dashing blockade runners were bringing in these very things under the Yankees' disgruntled noses, and that made the possession of them many times more thrilling. Soon Raphael Semmes and the Confederate Navy would tend to those Yankee gunboats and the ports would be wide open. And England was coming in to help the Confederacy win the war, because the English mills were standing idle for want of Southern cotton. and naturally the British aristocracy sympathized with the Confederacy as one aristocrat with another, against a race of dollar lovers like the Yankees.